The GI Research Foundation was able to produce this podcast with a generous sponsorship from Metro Infusion Centers. Welcome to Visceral, a podcast of the GI Research Foundation. I'm your host, Anna Gomberg, and today we have a very special guest, one of my most favorite people, Dr. David Rubin. Dr. Rubin is the Joseph B. Kirzner Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Section of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the University of Chicago Medicine, where he also serves as the Director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center. He was recently elected the chair of the International Organization for the Study of Inflammatory Bowel Disease, IOIBD, an organization whose mission is to promote the health of people with IBD worldwide by setting the direction for patient care, education, and research. And we are so fortunate to have Dr. Rubin with us today. He's going to lead us through something that experts in IBD everywhere talk about all the time, addressing the state of inflammatory bowel disease right here, right now, and the top 10 challenges faced by healthcare providers, researchers, and patients living with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Welcome, Dr. Rubin. We are so glad that you are here, and we cannot wait to hear what you have to share with us.
Well, hi, Annie. Thank you for having me, and I want to thank the Gastrointestinal Research Foundation for hosting this really important discussion. I have been thinking a lot about where we are in the world of IBD. I've been doing this for a while now, as you know, and I've had the privilege to gain some perspective on both the progress we've made, which is considerable, and the additional work we have left to do, which is also considerable. I was asked at a meeting in Paris recently to speak to the challenges in IBD. And that was all the instruction I was given, was just the title. And it was a wonderful title because it stimulated me to organize my thoughts into what I think are the 10 challenges facing us in inflammatory bowel disease at the end of 2025 and moving into 2026. And I appreciate the opportunity to share an updated version of that for your listeners and for all those out there who are motivated and understand some of this. I encourage you to continue the hard work that we have left in front of us and to continue supporting the organizations like the GI Research Foundation that are working to solve these challenges. So let's get right into it. The first challenge on my list of 10 is that we haven't cured IBD yet. What sounds like an obvious challenge, but also one that's incredibly complex. The recognition that we haven't cured IBD is, of course, very obvious, but often it gets left behind when we're talking about all of our new therapies. But we know that this is the ultimate goal, is understanding both the causes, plural, and cures for the inflammatory bowel diseases. And what we call Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis currently, we recognize and have recognized are really more like 20 or 30 different conditions. The body only has a certain way of expressing itself. So anything that results in chronic or long-term inflammation that can cause damage will look somewhat similarly. And we classify diseases into their different names in order to understand prognosis, in order to develop treatments. But getting back to the origin story, we want to understand why is it happening in the first place? And when we understand that, we can then work to eradicate the disease, or to use the term, cure it. And cure is defined in different ways, but for most people and those listening, I suspect it has some similar features. It means the disease is no longer present in the way it affects the individual. It means the individual does not require any medical therapy or other treatments to manage it. And of course, it also means that it's durable, that it doesn't come back, that it is gone in these ways over some period of time. In cancer, of course, the term cure is usually applied to no evidence of disease after 5 years. But we now even accept that some cancers are treated chronically as opposed to trying for just cure. So as we think about why we haven't cured IBD, it becomes a bit more obvious that it's complicated, that it actually is many more diseases than the two that we usually classify it as, and that we have a lot more work to do to figure some of this out. The good news is that we've made progress in this regard. We are breaking down the IBDs into many different components. There have been tremendous discoveries, including the first gene for Crohn's at the University of Chicago in 2001, which was funded by the GI Research Foundation, that work. and of course, over 300 subsequent genetic associations. But very importantly, and I think key to this, is the recognition that there are environmental shifts that seem to be contributing to much of this. If you ask patients or family members about IBD, they often will point to the environment. And in that way, I mean stress, diet, where they're living. And we're looking at those trends globally, which is another challenge I'll talk about in a minute. Now, to address this, there's many people working very hard, but one of the organizations that's working hard is the one you included in your introduction. I'm really honored to chair the International Organization for the Study of IBD, IOIBD. And over the next 3 years, when I'm doing that, and I expect subsequently, we are working to reclassify the IBDs and to do so first in a clinical manner that makes sense. So we're going to take the diseases apart and not think of them as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis as much as inflammation of the large intestine or the small intestine, and then look even at a molecular level to try to piece together different ways of characterizing these diseases, and then have more information that will gain understanding of why certain treatments work or don't. And we expect will also, of course, help us look for causes, develop cures, and have new strategies for prevention, which is a huge one, and we'll come to that as well. So the next challenge, number 2 of 10, is that inflammatory bowel disease has really become a global disease. And this may be more obvious to some of our listeners, but it didn't happen overnight. In the older days, IBD was acknowledged as a disease of the Western world, a disease of the industrialized nations, in some analyses, a disease of the Northern Hemisphere. And there were all these observations that suggested this wasn't something you would see in other parts of the world, in other places where they were more rural than urban or less industrialized. But in fact, everywhere you look now across the world, you can find inflammatory bowel disease. And this is not just an observational bias because we have more technology. It actually is related to true global epidemiologic shifts with rising IBD incidences. That means new cases in a set population, as well as a growing prevalence, number of people living with the diseases all over the world. Whether you look at pediatric IBD, which is rising in most studies that have looked at this, or you look at the adult onset IBD or the adult diagnosed IBD, you can see it going up everywhere. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. We certainly have a number of studies of urbanization that suggests that the more urbanized people are, the more likely they are to have inflammatory bowel disease. A really nice study in India that went literally door to door in rural districts in India was able to characterize the prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease in places where we thought it didn't happen. And the reasons for it were at least associated with the urbanization, indoor plumbing, or access to vaccinations and antibiotics, or specific dietary strategies and habits. There are a variety of different things that I'm sure everyone listening has some ideas about, but we're starting to get better ideas that this is being driven, in fact, by changes in our food chain, changes in the environment becoming too clean or too contaminated, depending on which side of the coin you're studying. The other reason we're seeing more IBD around the world is that, thankfully, people don't die from these conditions. And you see a rising prevalence because once you're diagnosed, usually at a younger age, you have the disease your entire life. Hopefully, it's managed, but that's part of this. There's also the recognition and establishment now of what we call older onset or elderly onset, excuse the expression, IBD. So people who are over 50 or 60 developing new IBD, or maybe just getting diagnosed with IBD that's been there for 40 years, but very mild and progressed. So you can look at different reasons that we're seeing IBD all over the world go up. But the bottom line is that it is. And of course, it's expensive. And there's a lot of reasons that we should be studying it and working hard to figure it out. The third challenge of 10 is that there remains a large gap in effective therapies. What we call primary response and success, meaning the treatment works, and secondary loss of response or secondary non-response, where the therapy is working, but then it stops working. And this has been well described in our field for many years. The good news is that we've made some progress. We have newer therapies with new mechanisms. That could be an entire series of podcasts. But we also have learned that when we treat people with any of these therapies, if we achieve deeper levels of control, the bowel is healed, the labs are normal. There are different markers that we now know represent not just that the patient has improvement in symptoms, which is absolutely necessary, but that we're modifying the disease process, which results in less loss of response over time. And there is the development of novel combination strategies. We're now learning, not surprisingly, that when we combine some of our new techniques and new treatment options, we can gain much better control. And that does include early access to surgery in some people. So for someone newly diagnosed with Crohn's, we sometimes now consider surgery, not because they're obstructed or have an infectious complication, but actually to gain control of what has already been causing damage for some period of time before the diagnosis, and then to focus on prevention of it returning, which is a very successful strategy in most people. So lots of new ways to approach this, but the gaps remain, and we have to continue putting the pressure on to identify new mechanisms of action, looking at improvement of our existing mechanisms so that treatments are actually used to achieve disease modification and not just response with symptom improvement, and monitoring of the disease, which means not waiting for complications or for people to feel terrible, but rather being proactive in monitoring the disease. And of course, there are other podcasts in this series where we've talked about some of those advances, including bedside intestinal ultrasound. But there are many other tools in our tool belt now that can help us monitor the disease, and good research that we're doing and that the GI Research Foundation has funded, looking at biosensors and wearables and novel ways to predict inflammation before you even feel it. So we have a lot of work to do, but we're making some exciting progress across all fronts here. The fourth challenge of 10 is that there is a large disconnect between our patients and clinicians in the way we communicate. We've seen this for many years now in surveys that we've performed and interviews we've done with patients. And often what patients are thinking their goals should be, or their preferences about those goals, are distinctly different than what the clinicians who take care of them are thinking they should be. This is quite important, and it's a disconnect that we need to bridge. So for example, I just went through why we're not achieving all the goals we want in therapies. Part of that also is because we don't take the time to explain to people living with inflammatory bowel disease that we want them to be in remission and what remission is actually supposed to be. It's supposed to be the absence of symptoms, the modification of the disease process, controlling the inflammation, and returning to an unencumbered high quality of life, which means full functioning. And it includes a holistic approach to this. That means making sure the joints are okay, the skin is okay, that mental health is being addressed. All of these things have to be included in our management of patients and discussion with them of what we're trying to accomplish. And similarly, the patients need to feel comfortable and confident that we're able to get there and that they can communicate with us. That remains a big challenge, and one that I think education and ongoing communication and even this podcast can help us bridge. So raising expectations and getting everyone on the same page is really important. The fifth challenge of 10 is that IBD management has become too complicated. Now, in some ways, you might say, that's a good thing. It means we're teasing things apart. We have more options than ever before. But the reality is that more and more therapies have been approved by regulatory agencies here in the US. That's the FDA. In Europe, it's the EMA, and every other part of the world has their own regulatory agencies. But that doesn't mean that it makes sense where new treatments should go or how we should apply them or use them in patients. Regulatory agencies provide guidance really for industry and provide labels related to first safety and then secondarily the effectiveness of therapies. But we should recognize that as new therapies keep coming, and I'm sure many of you have seen the commercials on TV and the direct consumer advertising, it's not entirely clear which treatment we should use first, which treatment we should use if that's not working, how we optimize individual therapies, and when we should combine therapies. It's become too complicated. And I accept responsibility for that, as I have encouraged my colleagues to. We need to work on ways to simplify. One of the ways that we have encouraged people to think about this is using a treat-to-target strategy. Treating to a target means that we agree that we want patients to feel better quickly, and that we have specific targets of disease management that we're trying to accomplish in order to achieve longer-term disease control. And what's inherent in the treat-to-target strategy is an assessment of the disease activity serially over short periods of time to reassess how people are doing and to adjust the therapy, add a second treatment, or switch course completely as we're going through all this. And it's a very important idea. It requires operational aspects of it in your own practice as a clinician or for patients to understand what we're trying to do. And it also requires recognition that the targets we're trying to achieve actually end up being somewhat individualized based on the patient. Where is your disease? What is a marker of your activity that we can rely on and that we're trying to control? Not everybody has the same biomarkers of inflammation or the same manifestations of their disease. So for different people, we have different targets. Now, getting back to the International Organization for the Study of IBD, they have led the world in defining some of these targets in a consensus statement that's called STRIDE. And STRIDE 2 was published a few years ago. And right now, the group is working on STRIDE 3. And what we expect is that STRIDE 3 will move the field forward and help people understand, including patients, of course, what we're trying to achieve so that we can get there with more of our therapies.
Today's episode is made possible by Metro Infusion Centers. Metro Infusion Centers, with over 220 infusion centers nationwide, providing trusted and life-saving therapies to patients for over 30 years in a comfortable and cost-effective environment.
The sixth challenge that I've outlined, and I think is a really important one, is we haven't figured out how to incorporate diet into our management across the spectrum of the diseases. It's the number one thing people want to know about. What should I eat? What shouldn't I eat? Can I use diet to treat my disease? And it remains a big challenge in understanding the evidence and understanding how to do it. There certainly are data to support diet for children with IBD, and that's specifically and most oftenly Crohn's disease, where if we remove some of the components of the diet and provide a stripped-down elemental diet or even a partial elemental diet, we can, in fact, induce some control of the disease. That works to variable extents, but less well-studied in adults as well. But it's not a sustainable strategy. It doesn't provide a good quality of life over long-term. And as soon as it's stripped away, the disease tends to come right back. So we need to figure that part out. But we're also learning other parts about diet that I think are really important. Diet does improve quality of life, and there are simple adjustments that can be recommended that might make people feel better. But if paired with the treat-to-target strategy and the recognition that we still have to treat inflammation effectively, I think of it as something that is complementary and adjuvant to what we're doing otherwise. We also have some really innovative work that's been done more recently looking at such things as emulsifiers, which are ingredients in some of our foods that give them shelf life or help things remain mixed in a stable way. And emulsifiers, we have observed, break down the mucus lining and may expose the gut immune system to more antigens and trigger some inflammation. And a really important study was presented this past year looking at elimination or at least reduction of emulsifiers in a controlled way in a group of people with mild Crohn's. And they saw not only improvement in symptoms, but it downregulated some of the inflammation. So there's some good work going on. There's a lot more needed. And we need to make sure that we're paying careful attention to the distinction between diet, which is what people eat, and nutrition, which is what they need, and making sure we don't end up with people malnourished because of restrictive diets, which is not our strategy of management. So it's a big challenge that remains. The seventh of 10 challenges is that we are having difficulty recruiting into clinical trials. We have all these new options and new ideas and new mechanisms of action, or improved and engineered better mechanisms of existing targets, but we are having difficulty completing clinical trials. This is in part because we have an embarrassment of riches in the availability of many therapies in places like the United States and Western Europe. But it also is a challenge because, of course, we want to do things better and we need good evidence to drive change and to move us forward. So there's been a shift to recruitment in Eastern Europe, in Asia, places that don't have access to a lot of therapies, which raises a whole bunch of ethical challenges to global clinical trial design and execution. But we also need to address the elephants in the room. Patients don't want to be exposed to placebo. And other than when we have a very new mechanism that requires a careful placebo comparator, I think there are some strategies and types of designs that we can use now in 2025, 2026, that will avoid that and enable us to have comparator arms of active therapy. And we need to educate patients and we need to move our field forward to include more people in trials so that we can get better evidence to drive our field forward. Now, some of this, of course, too, is understanding where are the gaps. Let's address the gaps in our field with trials that are pragmatic and are thoughtful about how to take care of these people and not only develop me-too drugs and continue to do the same things, even if they're a bit better. We want to do something new, and we need to think about who's going to benefit and then design a trial that makes sense. This does require as well that we work hand in hand with industry, that's the pharmaceutical companies, and hand in hand with our regulatory agencies, that's the FDA in the US and others around the world, so that they can adopt and understand that patients don't want a colonoscopy at 3 months for their clinical trial participation, and they're not excited about being in a placebo arm. So we've designed some newer ways to do this, including something called a patient preference trial, where there are two arms in the trial that seem equally good, and we let the patient choose which one they might be in. There are ways to do this with statistical power and still get the information we need and to do it in a successful manner. So stay tuned on that, and hopefully we're going to continue addressing that very important challenge. The eighth challenge of 10, we can't afford IBD. And what I mean by that, of course, which sounds obvious to everyone, I'm sure, if you're living with IBD, is that individuals who have active disease can't afford to be missing work and not being present for parts of their life or their family, but also the therapies have become so expensive. And it's not just the individuals, even with co-pays and patient assistance, it's also expensive to society. And it's an acknowledgement that the cost of these therapies is driving the overall challenge in the field of getting people what they need, having access to therapies, and the recognition that the expensive treatments that have made a big difference to people are not available to everybody is something that we must confront and think more about. In addition, you could argue, well, the cost of the therapies and the money that's being made drives the next new therapy and the next breakthrough. I certainly understand and agree with that, but there are many ways we could improve how insurance companies interact with us and how we are using resources in more effective and efficient ways. So I'm not here to say the insurance companies are all the bad guys here. I really want to emphasize that we need to figure out better ways to use the resources we have. And we also need to look really very clear-eyed at the people who don't have access to therapy and who don't have access to expertise and try to solve for those problems. And this is true around the world as well, as I hinted at in my comment about the ethics of global clinical trials, taking advantage of people who don't have access to therapies so that they're more likely to be in a trial. only works if you're then going to make that therapy available for all the people in that country who need the therapies subsequently. The ninth challenge that I identified in the list is that we need to focus more on prevention. Prevention in IBD takes many flavors and forms. At the very basic, it's prevention of relapse, which is what maintenance is supposed to be. Many people think of maintenance and needing maintenance therapy in IBD, which is a cornerstone of our standard management, as being taking care of a chronic disease that's chronically active by taking chronic medicine. That's actually not what maintenance of remission is supposed to be. Maintenance of remission is about prevention of relapse over time and prevention of progression of the disease to complications. So that's prevention. But what about prevention of recurrence after surgery? So one of the fundamental features of Crohn's disease, and one we still haven't figured out, is that the disease can come back after you've had a bowel resection and when the bowel segments are sewn back together. We don't know why this happens. We have some clues, but we've gotten very good at preventing it and monitoring for it. So we've learned, for example, that after a surgical resection of a segment of bowel in Crohn's that's active and scarred or inflamed, we can predict the likelihood of recurrence, and we can use our therapies, which are much more effective as preventive agents than they are when we're trying to catch up after there's already been progression or complications. There's also the recurrence of inflammation that occurs in people with ulcerative colitis who have a colectomy with a J pouch. We know that about 50% of them will have some inflammation of the J pouch at least once. 10% may have more chronic inflammation in the J pouch. That's because the individual still has IBD. It's just in a new place. So if we know that there's a risk of this developing, and we know that people can be predicted to have it in some situations, we should have a better strategy for preventing it. And there's ongoing work that's going on to try to figure that out. And of course, what you might have thought I was thinking about was prevention of the disease onset altogether. The good news is that there's some incredible work going on around the world to try to figure this out. Some of it is being led by something called the GEM study, which is genetics, environment, and microbiome, led by our colleague Ken Cretoro in Toronto, but in a global effort to recruit unaffected siblings of people with Crohn's disease and then follow them over time. They've been able to identify a whole bunch of pre-diagnosis markers and some predictive value to know who may develop Crohn's. We recognize already from lots of old studies that the highest risk of developing Crohn's disease is having a sibling with Crohn's disease. Well, what they've done is they've identified genetic markers, they've identified functional markers in terms of how the bowel reacts and how it's leaky or not, is a term many of you may have heard, but also looking at subclinical markers of inflammation to know before the person has any symptoms or damage that they're in fact starting to become inflamed. Learning from diabetes, we can apply a strategy to then try to prevent the disease. And that's underway. We're working hard to work to develop that, to design it. That's in conjunction with the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York and a group of people around the world, including the University of Chicago. I do want to highlight that there's another study called INTERCEPT, which is being performed in Europe, that is going to try to do the same thing using a therapy to try to prevent onset. So I want to acknowledge our great colleagues around the world who are working on this, and that's an exciting area, but we need better approaches to doing so. So lots to do there. I've already hinted as well about wearables and other ways to understand when the disease is recurring so we can prevent clinical relapse. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this in the next year. And my 10th of 10 challenges for us to think about is to make sure that people like me are training my replacements, our replacements in the field, recognizing that we need to recruit the smartest people to come into GI and work in inflammatory bowel disease. We need to support them properly through all of their training, and we have to provide them with adequate resources so that they can be in the labs doing that hard work, so that they can get the skill sets necessary to become successful and to make the next discoveries. I think one of the most important things we do in our life is to pass on what we've done well to the next generation, but also to acknowledge our limitations and look to a better future by having the next generation take over for us. And so our 10th of 10 challenge is to identify and train our replacements. And I'm happy to say and optimistic to say that there's an amazingly smart group of people coming up in the ranks in IBD, and there is a very bright future for us coming. So I hope that you have thought about these challenges with me today. If you're in a position to impact these challenges, I encourage you to go for it. And I also will reflect again that we all have to be working together. So if you can support the Gastrointestinal Research Foundation, if you are in industry or you're a physician or a physician scientist working in these fields, I want to encourage everyone to continue rowing in the same direction. And I look forward to an ongoing discussion about solving all these problems. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rubin, for sharing your valuable time with us. And all of these insights are so important for anyone who is living with IBD or studying it or hoping to make a difference in the lives of those who are living with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis in 2025. We are so grateful. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast Visceral from the GI Research Foundation. This episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Anna Gomberg, and edited and mixed by Luke Pahalski. Special thanks to the talented Michael Collins Dowden, who composed our theme music, and executive producer Allison Thielen. We hope you will join us next time, and until then, to access other podcasts and learn more about research to treat, prevent, and cure digestive diseases, please visit the website at giresearchfoundation.org. Please like and subscribe to Visceral on all your favorite podcast platforms, and until next time, listen to your gut. Thank you again to our sponsors, Metro Infusion Centers.